Information, please. Presented each week at this time by Canada Dry, famous the world over for its fine beverages. Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts and enjoy a glass of refreshing Canada Dry ginger ale. Every week at this time, Canada Dry furnishes a group of four fine but sometimes frightening scholars who sit here and gobble up the questions you feed them. When you send in one that sticks them, then you win. Here's how it goes. You may submit from 1 to 3 questions with the correct answers. For every question we use, whether or not it's answered correctly, the sender gets $5. And if your question stumps our board of experts, you not only get $10 more, but in addition, you receive the complete 24 volumes of the recent edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Mind you, this is only if your question stumps our board of experts. Our editorial staff may reword your question a trifle. Don't worry about it. Whenever there is a duplication of questions, Information Please uses the one that was submitted first. All questions become the property of Information Please and should be addressed to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City. And now may I present our master of ceremonies, Mr. Clifton Fadiman, literary critic of the New Yorker magazine. Mr. Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again, we bring you Information Please, an unrehearsed and spontaneous program. Tonight we have with us our three regulars, Franklin P. Adams of the Magical Memory, conductor of the Conning Tower in the New York Evening Post, and well-known to all as F.P.A., Oscar Levant, the musician and composer who seems to be able to answer a lot of the general questions and pretty nearly all of the musical ones, John Kieran, the sports authority who continues to astonish us each week with his amazingly wide knowledge, and as our guest of honor, the well-known educator and psychologist, Walter B. Pitkin, who is known to millions as the author of Life Begins at 40 and other books. To our listeners, we say, remember, for each question that's missed, Canada Dry rings up $10, and that's paid out to the sender, plus 24 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, gentlemen, we're off with a question from A. Morton of this city, which is a musical question. I'm going to ask you to identify the conspicuous items in recent news, which are suggested by the music you're going to hear. For example, if you heard someone play The Bear Went Over the Mountain, followed by Finlandia, what would that suggest to you? Mr. Kieran.
That Russia walked into Finland.
Yes, the invasion of Finland by Russia. Now, that was just an example. We're going to have three different sets of musical compositions played. Let's have the first.
What's the name of that?
Wait a minute now. Got another one coming. Thank you very much. Now, there were two compositions played. They suggest what recent news item? Mr. Levant and Mr. Kieran both had their hands up. Mr. Levant first,
I think. Well, California, here I come, suggests the invitation to Tennessee to play in the Rose Bowl tournament.
That's exactly right. And what was the first composition?
I had no idea.
What were you going to say?
Back home in Tennessee.
Just try to picture me down home in Tennessee. Mr. Kieran, absolutely right. Between them, they got it exactly. Yes, Tennessee is invited to play the University of Southern California. Let's have the second set of compositions. There'll be two of them now.
That's Turkey in the Straw.
That's right. We're going to have another one now. Hold on. All you have to do is put these together, gentlemen.
Who did they ask to leave some country town?
Who? That's the question. Mr. Kieran, what you
I think
say?
They asked Russia to get out of the League of Nations.
Well, that isn't Russia.
No, just a moment. We have Turkey in the Straw played as our first composition. The second composition, Mr. Levant, was what?
Get
out of town. Now put those together, and what do you get?
This could be dangerous if I answered it. I have an idea, but it isn't...
All right.
You know me.
Hold it. You have an idea, Kieran? Adams? Mr. Pitkin?
Has it got to do with Texas?
Nope, not a bit. Neither death nor Texas. The answer is this. There have been some recent rumors that the German envoy to Turkey, Von Papen, is no longer welcome there. Remember it?
That's wonderful. Turkey in the Straw.
Turkey in the Straw and get out of town. Aren't we clever?
Oh, you
very
are.
Good. One wrong. Now, gentlemen, we have to get 2 out of 3 on this. That means you have to get the next one absolutely right. Let's have it. Mr. Kieran can hardly contain himself. Mr. Kieran?
Well, that's the wedding march. What's the second part?
That's all there is. There isn't any more.
Well, that means Mr. Levant.
Mr. Levant, yes. Mr. Levant was recently married to Miss June Gale, and we are playing the wedding march, Oscar.
I didn't know that.
If you don't mind.
You don't mind bringing that up to you?
No, don't let me make any remarks.
No, no. I've got you muzzled for the rest of the evening. Very well, we did get 2 out of 3 on that. Getting by with a question. The next one from S. Edwards of Boston runs as follows. Mr. Pitkin wrote a famous book called Life Begins at 40. I'm going to ask you to identify these celebrities for whom life began before they were 40. We have to get 4 out of 4. Now, the first one became a celebrated prime minister before he was 25. Who would that be? Mr. Kieran and Mr. Levant both have their hands up. Mr. Kieran.
Pitt.
Pitt the Younger or Pitt the Elder?
Pitt the Younger.
Pitt the Younger, yes. Who was appointed by George III. What were you going to say, Mr.
Sir William Pitt.
William Pitt, yes. Another name for him, Mr. Levant, you know?
Pittsburgh. He named the Pittsburgh
Not Paris. A bit of it. You never get by with
Pittsburgh
that.
Pittsburgh was named after him.
It's true.
I know, but another name for Mr. Pitt himself, the Earl of... Earl of Chatham, Mr. Pitkin tells us. Now, in this case, the person who was not 40 created an empire for himself, as a matter of fact, before he was 35. Created an empire before he was 35. Mr. Levant had his hand up first.
Alexander the Great.
Alexander the Great. And you might possibly... Would you allow Napoleon, do you think, Mr. Pitkin? I think that he is.
I think I should.
Yes, I think so. One who became a United States cabinet minister before he was 33.
That's not allowed, is it?
It was allowed in those days, apparently. Yes, I think it is.
Well, otherwise I would have been in, but they told me I was too young.
What portfolio?
Without portfolio, minister.
Without portfolio. Traveling cabinet minister. Well, how about it? A United States cabinet minister before he was 33. Oh, I think we should all know that. I even know it myself.
What was his position?
Hamilton.
That would give it away.
Yeah.
Mr. Pitkin?
Hamilton.
Hamilton, yes. Alexander Hamilton, Secretary of the Treasury. He was born in 1757 and appointed as secretary in 1790. Now, in this case, the person became a famous actor and a benefactor of the legal profession before he was 14. Before he was 14. Who would that be?
Baby Leroy.
No. Don't know that Baby Leroy was a benefactor of the legal profession. Besides, he's through, Mr. Levan. What were you going to say, Mr. Kerry? Only one possible answer on this.
Jackie Coogan.
Nope, sorry. Only one possible answer, and it's Freddie Bartholomew. Freddie Bartholomew became a famous actor before he was 14, and hasn't he been involved for a long time in a legal suit?
Yes.
By which I understand he doesn't make a great deal of money, but the lawyers perhaps make some out of him.
Again, not a lot of making.
I don't know whether that's true or not, but apparently he is a benefactor of the legal profession in that sense. Well, one wrong. You missed on Freddie Bartholomew. He's supposed to get all on that. So Mr. Edwards gets $10, courtesy of Canada Dry. The next question comes from Dessa Harriman of Lewisburg, Pennsylvania. Have to get all 4 on this too, gentlemen. With whom is each of the following thank you expressions associated? I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul, Mr. Adams.
William Ernest Henley.
William Ernest Henley. The poem is called what?
Invictus.
Invictus, yes. Meaning?
Unconquered.
Unconquered. Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Thank you, Mr. Atkins. Mr. Keurig.
That's from Kipling's Tommy Atkins.
That's right. Give us a line or two, which will recall it for us, Mr. Kieran.
And only a line or two.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins. When the trooper's on the tide, when the trooper's on the tide, my boy, and so forth.
All right, all right. I'm sure he could have gone on with it. Now, here's another thank you expression. For this relief, much thanks. For this relief, much thanks. It's Adams.
It is bitter cold, and I am sick at heart.
Hey, that's pretty good. Where's it from?
Hamlet.
Hamlet, what act, what scene?
Act 1, scene 1.
Yeah, that's pretty good, Mr. Pitkin, isn't it? Yeah, very good.
That's about as far as I got.
Quite right. One of the gods is relieving the other.
Marcellus.
I think it's Bernardo and Francisco, but I'm not sure.
Marcellus comes to the relief.
I believe so. Now, here is the fourth and last of these thank you expressions. Thank you, my mother thanks you, my father thanks you, my sister thanks you, my whole family thank you.
Who is that?
You don't know, Mr.
He's a lavish fellow.
He is lavish, yes. One of the most generous.
Mr. George M. Cohan.
George M. Cohan, yes. And when did he say that?
In vaudeville.
When he was one of the 4 Cohans.
Well, he used to say it very constantly. It was a set curtain speech, I think, with Mr. Cohan.
I think when he was in vaudeville.
Very possibly. That gives us 4 out of 4.
Thank you for a lovely evening.
This isn't over yet. Hold on, Mr. Levant. Here's another from L. Newman of Miami, Florida. Oh, this is right up your alley, Mr. Levant. Mind doing a little work? You're going to be asked to identify the following tunes and play the title songs of the shows from which they were taken. Is that perfectly unclear? For example, if we did play Where or When, you would play what, Mr.
Babes and Arms.
You'd play Babes and Arms, but we're not going to ask you to do that. Very well. Now, we're going to have the first tune played. Mr. Levant will identify it and then play the title song of the show from which it's taken. Number one. All right, Mr. Levant.
Who from Sonny?
Yep. Let's have the second.
That's by Jerome Kern, my favorite.
Jerome Kern, quite right.
That's the man I love.
That's right. From what?
Well, it was actually in many shows, but I think originally it was in Strike Up the Band.
Strike Up the Band. You going to play that for him? If you people want to have Mr. Levant for any Saturday evening party, just address all inquiries for information, please. Let's have the third. Mr. Levant, what's that?
That's you, the Tops, from Anything Goes.
From Anything Goes. You going to play Anything Goes for him?
Just a little bit. Right. Right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Levant. Sometimes I wish you could tell us how we could select some questions that would stump you.
Sometimes I think I'd be better off dead.
Oh, the hairbreadth distinction, but I don't think...
Spoken like a bridegroom.
Harold P. Shapiro of Toledo, Ohio, sends in a question, oh, quite seasonal, too, about marriage. Name a piece of literature in which someone marries the following. A doctor, a lawyer, an Indian, and a thief. A piece of literature in which someone marries a doctor. Mr. Levant.
Arrowsmith.
Arrowsmith, very good. Who marries whom?
Helen Hayes marries Ronald Coleman.
That's what you know about it, Mr. Levant. Remember the name of the hero and heroine. You know, all these books, Mr. Levant, actually have...
Read them, but the pictures deflect my original reaction.
I know, but you know that in the book there are other names than those that you know. I just want you to get that clear.
Mrs. Arrowsmith in the book.
That's right. Leora Toza married Martin Arrowsmith. Now, in this piece of literature in which someone marries a lawyer. Miss Kieran?
Life of Abraham Lincoln by Carl Sandburg. Mary Todd married Abraham Lincoln, a lawyer.
Good enough.
It's not a novel, though.
No, but I didn't
say it's a work of literature.
It's a work of literature and a very good one, Mr. Levant.
Oh.
Counselor at Law, perhaps, a play that ran some years ago by Elmer Rice. A Shakespearean play in which someone marries a lawyer.
Portia.
Yes.
Bassanio.
Bassanio marries Portia in The Merchant of
Venice. That's the reverse.
I beg pardon?
Well, I guess it's all right.
The news short. Name a piece of literature in which someone marries an Indian. An Indian? Mr. Levant.
Mabel Dodge Luann's Reminiscences, which are... Is that true? I don't want to go any further. She married an Indian. She still married him.
I think so, yes, according to last reports. Perhaps you can think of another. Mr. Kieran?
Hiawatha by Longfellow.
Yes, yes. That's a much more classic response. Mr. Levant, much more up to date. Hiawatha married whom in the poem?
Minnie Hoff.
Minnie Hoff. And a piece of literature in which someone marries a thief. There aren't very many that you can get to answer this. Do you have it, Mr. Levant?
I don't have it on the tip of my tongue, just before the tip. That's how far back it is. Wait a minute.
He's a thief before he's married?
Who?
Raffles. Raffles.
I don't know that Raffles gets married.
Well, he gets old. He ought to get married.
Oh, it's very possible.
He never gets caught.
Glad to get this free advice, Mr. Levant. The answer is...
Arsène Lupin.
No, I don't think... I think the only... Well, the only one I can think of at the moment is Moll Flanders, the 18th century novel by Daniel Defoe. She marries a highwayman, and she's a thief herself, too, making all very cozy. Very well. They were supposed to get 3 out of 4 on that, and they did. Now, up to the present moment, we seem to have paid out, Canada Dry has paid out $10 and one set of encyclopedia. For those framers of questions, just too tough for the home team. Mr. Cross, we await a moderate quantity of your golden words, Ray Canada Dry.
Thank you, Mr. Fadiman. An anecdote is told of a violinist who, upon reading the proofs of a concert program, found himself described as Mr. X, that famous virtuoso of the violin. Whereupon he said to the manager, "Please change this to read Mr. X, the violinist. If I am a virtuoso, my audience has already found it out. If I'm not, well, they'll soon find that out, too." The sense of that anecdote applies directly to these brief talks about sparkling Canada Dry water. The dictionary offers us thousands of glowing adjectives that I might use in describing our sparkling water. But I don't use them because this club soda is its own best salesman. When you drink sparkling Canada Dry water, you realize without my telling you that it mixes well, adds flavor, and that its life and sparkle are long-lasting. So all I ask you to do is to try sparkling Canada Dry water. Then if you'd like to tack a string of adjectives onto it, go right ahead. I have no doubt you'll want to. It's that good.
Miss Cross, your career as raconteur and adjective lever outer lasted exactly 61 seconds. We go on to the second half of our program with a question coming to us from C. Roots Reese of Greenwich, Connecticut. Now, this question is about familiar expressions or phrases that deal with going places. For example, if I said, to go to Canossa, what would that mean? Miss Kira?
That would mean a pilgrimage of penitence.
Yes. You suffer a sort of humiliation.
Because I've forgotten just which one of the European kings went to Canossa to plead for pardon from the Pope.
That's quite right. I wish I could give you credit for that. It's a perfect response, but it isn't part of the regular question. Yeah. Now, if you went to Coventry, what would that mean? Miss Kira?
That means that you would be sent into set aside for shame. You were put into a place of punishment.
What would the punishment be?
Well, it would be confined. Originally, I believe, Coventry, of course, is a town in England.
Yes.
And, I've forgotten what the exact implication is now. I know it's a place of...
isolation.
Derogatory implication.
Yes, that's true, but there's a specific punishment that... you have to undergo if you're sent to Coventry.
You have to keep quiet, I guess.
That's it. You're excluded from social intercourse. No one may talk to you. There's a story that, I don't know, sometime in the 18th century, the women of Coventry disliked...
A lone Lady Godiva was one.
Was it in Coventry?
Yes.
They disliked soldiers for one reason or another, my informant tells me, and they ostracized any girl who spoke to one. I don't know whether that legend is true. I hardly know whether to count you correct or not on that, Miss Kieran. What would you like to be counted?
Well, if you want to count me wrong, then I'll tell you the first sentence of that Lady Godiva poem is, I stood upon the bridge at Coventry.
Oh, thank you very much. Now, if I, if you went to the ant, A-N-T, if you went to the ant, what would that mean? Miss Adams?
You would consider her ways and be wise.
Yes, what does it mean exactly? What sort of person would you be if you went to the ant?
A sluggard.
A sluggard, yes. You'd be lazy and you'd be advised to mend your ways.
Thou sluggard.
Where's it from, Adams?
Probably Ecclesiastes.
Gee, I hadn't even expected you'd give me the book. It's from the Bible. I'm not sure which book it is.
Well, that's pretty vague.
Go to the ant, thou sluggard. Consider her ways and be wise. Now, if you went... If this occurred in England and you went to the country in England, what would that mean? You went to the country. Miss Kieran?
He could go back and try to be re-elected to Parliament.
Yes, but what does it mean to go
stand
to the country?
Stand for election.
That has a more specific meaning than that. You're on the right track.
Oh, it's a prime minister appeal.
Oh, not necessarily.
A government appeal for an endorsement of whatever by re-election.
Yes, well, you make an appeal to your constituency, whether it might be a minor election. It might not necessarily be a prime ministerial.
What was it I said in the first place?
Parliament.
Yes. That'll do. All right.
He was right an hour ago.
Good enough. What would happen to you if you went to Gretna Green? Gretna Green. Let's do that.
You'd either get married or join the National Guard.
What does Gretna Green mean to you, Mr. Levant?
National Guard.
Not to me. Mr. Adams?
An eloping place.
Yes, where is it?
In England somewhere.
Yes, not quite in England.
No.
Mr. Kieran?
It's just over the border to Scotland.
And why do people elope to Gretna Green, Mr. Kieran?
Because you can get married there without any preliminary warning.
Yes, very, very simple. Well, we're supposed to get 3 out of 4 on that, and we did, gentlemen. The next question from K.J. Thicket of this city is about some famous retreats, military retreats. Identify the following retreats in fiction. Name the wars in which they occurred and the novels that describe them. The first is the retreat from Caporetto. The retreat from Caporetto. Miss Kira.
I think that is a farewell to arms.
That's quite right. By whom?
One of our moderns,
Hemingway.
Hemingway, as Mr. Levant reminds us. And the war referred to as what?
The World War.
And the retreat?
Was the Italian retreat when, I think it was either Mackinson or Falkenhayn took 2 weeks off from the main bout and went down to attack the Italian army.
I don't know whether that's precisely correct, but I'd be willing to bet several hats that it is, Mr. Jones. The retreat from St. Francis. The retreat from St. Francis. In what war did it occur? Who did the retreating? What book do you find the retreat described in? That's the toughest of these four, I think.
Is that one of the Henrys?
No, it's the French and Indian War, the retreat of Rogers' Rangers with the English, and you'll find it in Northwest Passage by Kenneth Roberts, which was a great bestseller a year or two ago. The retreat from Atlanta. The retreat from Atlanta, Miss Adams?
The retreat of Joseph Johnston's army, very likely, or Hood's army, from Atlanta, described in probably Gone with the Wind and other articles of fiction.
Retreat of which kind?
Retreat of the Confederate Army.
Retreat of the Confederate Army and described, as you say, in Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. That's quite right. And finally, the retreat from Moscow. The retreat from Moscow. Mr. Levant.
Well, that's the famous Napoleonic retreat.
That's right.
Also depicted in music by Tchaikovsky.
Very good. But you have to give us a novelist.
The wonderful one, War and Peace by Tolstoy.
That's quite right, Mr. Levant. Very good.
There are other ones, too.
I don't know if there are others.
I don't want to show off. It would take me an hour.
We were supposed to get 3 out of 4 on that, and we did. Now, gentlemen, this question coming from J. Riley of New Orleans is about music, or rather non-music. You're going to hear a series of non-musical instruments, each of which has a prominent part in a well-known score. Identify the work. Let's have the first. Mr. Levant?
It could either be Silent Pictures, The Old Chase, or it could be The Windmill in Don Quixote, Richard Strauss.
Yes, that's right. The Wind Machine in Don Quixote, Richard Strauss. Very good. Let's have the second non-musical instrument. Familiar sound to you, gentlemen. Mr. Levant again.
I like when you refer to these in well-known scores.
Isn't it well-known?
You mean a typewriter? I think it was in George Antheil's Ballet Mécanique.
Yes, quite right.
It's also in, I think, Freddie Grofe's Tabloid. I'm not sure.
Hold
They're
on.
Not well-known. They've only had one performance.
Yeah.
To the composers, I think.
Ballet Mécanique, I think, was played.
Yeah, I heard that.
Isn't that the thing that was played with 16 piano?
Yes, I heard it. In Carnegie Hall.
Yeah,
it was an audience. I was there.
Let's have the third.
Get it? Why is he so violent? What is that, a pop?
Yeah.
Pop goes the weasel?
Oh, no, not the weasel. It's a cork popping.
Well, it's a sound effect.
Yep.
These fellows would be better off writing music, you know. Maybe in a nightclub suite, I don't know.
By whom?
Johnny Green.
That's quite right, Mr. DeBenner. Quite right. How do you happen to hit on these things that way? Quite right. All right, let's have the fourth and last. Mr. Levant?
Shoot the sherbet to me, Herbert.
What is the noise, Mr.
It's a machine gun.
Machine gun, you find it where?
Any Jimmy Cagney picture. I don't know.
Yes, but how about...
I'd like to hear some music, not these sound effects.
You gave us some music earlier in the evening. Now let us have our chance.
I don't know what that's from.
Well, you named it, as a matter of fact, a little earlier in the evening.
Shoot the sherbet to
me? No, you said that one. It's the Tabloid Suite of Freddie Grofe. Didn't you say that about something else?
I said about the typewriter.
Yes, you were wrong about the typewriter, but right about the machine gun. We were supposed to get 3 out of 4, and Mr. Levant got 3.5 out of 4. Good enough. Here's a question from Daniel J. Keene in New York City about Gilbert and Sullivan operas. In which of the Gilbert and Sullivan operas does each of the following occur? The first is a paradox, the second a dilemma, the third a quandary, and the fourth a pretty mess. Let's have a paradox. Where'd you get Mr. Levant?
The paradox is in Iolanthe.
No.
Pirates of Penzance.
Look at you quick.
Pirates of Penzance. The most amazing paradox.
Most amazing paradox.
Ingenious paradox. I'm wrong 3 times now.
Watch out for Mr. Adams.
You get permanent possession.
Now, a dilemma, gentlemen, comes from what Gilbert and Sullivan opera? A dilemma?
Nice dilemma we have here.
That's right, Mr. Adams. And what opera is that? A nice dilemma we have here that calls for all our wit. And at this stage, it don't appear that we can settle it. Remember it now?
I don't know. It might be Prince's either.
No, sorry. Trial by jury. I think this is the first time we ever got you down on a Gilbert and Sullivan answer, Mr. Adams. It's a great night for me. One wrong. How about a quandary, or as I believe in Great Britain, they sometimes pronounce it, quandary.
Quandary in the rhyme. There.
Quandary in the rhyme. And what is the rhyme, Adams?
And then a nice quandary.
Yes, but what rhymes with it?
Seminary.
It does, as a matter of fact, way at the end of the verse. A plague on this vagary, I'm in a nice quandary, a pasty tone with dances unknown, and it's from what opera, Mr. Adams?
Ireland.
Ireland, he's quite right. A pretty mess, a pretty mess.
Is as good as a mile.
Very good. Mikado.
The Mikado. Can you give us the lines, Mr. Adams, in which the words are pretty mess?
Oh, here's a how do you do, it begins.
Here's a pretty how do you do, is that it? Mm. Here's a pretty mess, in a month or less, I must die without a wedding, let the bitter tears I'm shedding witness my distress. Here's a pretty mess. Well, we got three out of four on that, too. We were supposed to get 3 out of 4. Couldn't get you gentlemen down this evening to any appreciable extent. Matter of fact...
You can get us out, but you can't get us down.
Yeah, pretty tough. A rapid glance at the cash register reveals that Canada Dry has paid out a total of only $10, which means one set of the Encyclopedia Britannica in addition. Now, Mr. Cross wants a few words with you, and then I'll be back with the lineup for next week.
Many in our audience may remember when Canada Dry Ginger Ale first made its debut. Many remember how its delightfully different taste and its truly mellow flavor rapidly won recognition as the champagne of ginger ales. Now, through the years, Canada Dry has cherished and made every effort to be worthy of this name, has maintained expensive laboratories to be sure all the ingredients used are only the very finest. The choicest Jamaica ginger, pure granulated sugar, water triple tested, delicious spices from the far corners of the world. So you see, there is good reason why Canada Dry is so delightfully different, so pure, so wholesome. A good reason why it's well known as the champagne of ginger ale. In this busy season, every once in a while, stop for a glass of Canada Dry ginger ale. It refreshes inwardly. It picks you up. In a word, it's gingivating. And remember, too, during the coming holidays, be sure you have a generous supply of Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling water. Your friends will appreciate it. Now, here's Mr. Fadiman.
Thank you, Mr. Cross. Now for the lineup for next week. Next week, our two steadies will be with us, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams. And as our guests, we welcome back, first by popular request, our literary friend Christopher Morley, whose new novel, Kitty Foyle, heads most of the bestseller lists these days. And as our second guest, we are honored to announce the world-famed violinist and composer, Albert Spaulding. To our listeners, we say, please send your questions along. If you have a stumper to stump our board of experts, let's have it. There are $5 in it for you if we use your question. And if your question stumps the experts, you get another 10 and a complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica, so you can win this new prize in addition to a maximum of $15. Send your letters with the questions and correct answers to Canada Dry, 1 Pershing Square, New York City.
Remember, Canada Dry ginger ale and sparkling water are on sale in convenient sizes at your favorite neighborhood stores. The large family size sells for only 15 cents. The medium size, 12 ounces, 3 for 25 cents. This is Milton Cross saying goodnight for Canada Dry. Until next week at this same time.